Hi, this is Michelle Morissette with PureChi.com, where our quest is to seek and provide the truth. One of our current areas of interest is the new following of Mahendra Trivedi. Trivedi, as some of you may be aware, has been called everything from the next Einstein to the second coming of Christ. Just those badges in particular are enough to catch your interest. So joining us here today is human behavioral expert, PhD, Patrick Juanes, who's been talking in the media recently about brainwashing and the dangers of gurus. Patrick, thank you so much for being with us here today.
My pleasure, Michelle.
So, maybe one of the ways to start this out, one of the most active media stories has been James Ray. Tell me what's happening with James Ray.
Well, this is a very powerful story, and you're right, Michelle. This is one of the reasons that I've been doing the media rounds, as they say, talking about brainwashing and the danger of gurus, and using specifically the case of James Arthur Ray. James Arthur Ray is probably known to a lot of your audience as a featured teacher in The Secret. James Arthur Ray is a self-help guru. He's also a New York Times best-selling author. He wrote a book about harmonic wealth and how to create harmonic wealth in all areas of your life. He was in the movie and in the book, The Secret. He was featured on Larry King and on Oprah. And in one of his retreats, known as Spiritual Warrior Retreat, he held a sweat lodge, and he led the sweat lodge himself, and it resulted in the deaths of three people. He was then charged criminally and recently was found guilty of three counts of negligent homicide, which means there's a good chance he's going to go to jail. But the interesting consequence of the James Ray case, in fact, there's many consequences. First is, were these people brainwashed? How do people get brainwashed? Two, is James Ray a cult leader or a guru? Three, what does this mean for the law of attraction and for the people, the millions of people around the world who've read and believe in The Secret and in the law of attraction? Well, let's start off first with the key topic, and this, there is a direct connection between the James Ray case and Mahendra Trivedi when we talk about the power of brainwashing, or we talk about how people can easily get led into some sort of group or become part of a cult or simply hand over tens and tens of thousands of dollars in the hope that their life is going to be transformed, whether we're talking about a mental transformation, a physical transformation, an emotional transformation, a financial transformation, or a spiritual transformation. So one of the things that I've been saying throughout the media is identifying how do people get brainwashed. And it can be summed up in one simple sentence. And I know this sounds like an oversimplification, but I'll explain it. Brainwashing occurs when I can say to you, you have a need, and I'm the only one that can give you, can fill that need. If that need is something that's really emotionally powerful and it becomes a void and it creates a sense of desperation, and I can convince you that I'm the only one, I'm your only answer, I'm your only solution, then it's easy for me to begin to have control over you. So again, the basic formula is convincing someone that they have a need and then saying, but I'm the only one that can help you. Now, what could those needs be? We have a series or basic set of emotional needs. One is love and connection, and love in many different forms. Brotherly love, sisterly love, romantic love. We also have love in terms of being able to connect with another human being. So we talk about love and connection. And when we talk about love and connection, we're talking about connection to a wider community. Now, this is critical, Michelle, because what I'm talking about here is a sense of belonging. So when you start talking about James Ray and people going to these retreats, they have a sense of community, a sense of belonging. I belong to this group. The same thing applies to people if they go to a retreat, a seminar held by Mahendra Trivedi. I have a sense of connection to other people. And you'll often see in the marketing, they'll talk about Come, be part of like-minded people. What does that mean? It means a connection to a community, a connection to people that are like me. Oh, they're similar to me. That means I feel better. I feel safe. I feel emotionally secure. So the first human emotional need is love and connection. The second is security. Now, security comes in many different forms. It's mental, emotional, physical, financial, spiritual. So if you don't have a place to live, you don't have security. So the first sense of security is the need for survival. But we also have security of, am I in a relationship? Do I have someone that I can depend on? We also have security in terms of mental and emotional support, someone to turn to in times of when I'm feeling weak or I'm feeling helpless or I have some sort of doubt. Security can also mean job and it can mean money. Security can mean, do I know where I'm going with my life? So we have love and connection, security. And I am giving you a lot of detail here, but there's a reason for this. So they're going to listen to this call, will understand how, if they have experienced the situation where they said, how did that person dupe me? How could I have been so stupid? How did I get brainwashed into this? Here is the answer. Number three is the opposite of security. It's challenge. We actually like to be challenged. We like to set a goal and be challenged. Can I make this happen? Can I achieve this? So we also need a challenge. The next one, and this is probably one of the most important ones, is significance. Do I feel significant? Do I feel important? Do I feel that someone actually needs me? So sometimes people will become part of a group, a part of a church, a part of a gathering, a part of a cult, because it makes them feel significant. On a more relatable level, why do kids get in gangs? We think, well, they're getting in gangs and they're committing acts of crime, or they're just standing around and doing nothing. This relates to a connection to a community, but it also relates to significance, because when I'm dressed this way or if I'm holding this weapon, I feel powerful and I feel significant. The next one, so we have love and connection, security, challenge, significance. The next one is meaning and purpose. Do I have a meaning and do I have purpose in my life? What am I going to do with my life? Am I living my passion? How can I make a difference? How can I have some meaning to my life? What is my purpose here? Then the final one is growth, personal growth. You know, particularly probably women even more than men, and although you're going to think what I'm saying is sexist, it's actually the opposite. Women have a greater sense of a desire for purpose, or growth rather, than even men do. Because women are always talking about changing. I want to change my hair. I want to change my fashion sense. I want to do this. I want to do that. Women are very much about evolving because of the entire female energy, which is about not just nurturing, it's about creation. So you're always growing. You're always evolving and creating. So, again, just going over those, love and connection, security, challenge, significance, meaning and purpose, and growth. If any of those needs are not being met, and someone comes along and he happens to either be well-marketed or happens to be charismatic and says, look, I have the answer for you. I can solve your problem. We then turn to this person. We can easily give away our power. We can easily put them on a pedestal and we start to hand them our money. Once we start handing them our money, we become emotionally and financially invested in this person, and so therefore we start to depend more on them and we start to give them greater significance, greater importance, and greater control over us. I also want to mention something else here, Michelle, which is I think is really relevant, is the brainwashing doesn't just occur from people who promote themselves as, you know, wise and gurus and healers and leaders and teachers. Brainwashing occurs every day, starting with the media. It starts with advertising. Every commercial does one thing. It says, there's something wrong with you, or there's something missing, and here is the answer. And it often does it to women. It says, ladies, you got to look younger. Ladies, you got to look skinnier. Ladies, you got to do something about your hair. You got to get rid of those wrinkles. You got to tighten up your bottom. You got to tighten up this. You got to do this. You got to do that. And then to guys, it's you got to have this car. You have to be this way and that way. So the media is always brainwashing every day by saying, you have a need. There's something wrong. There's something missing. Here is the answer. And that's why people end up going and buying stuff that they don't really need. And you'll even hear terms like, particularly when they're selling, you know, prescription medication, it'll be like, do you toss and turn at night? You might be suffering from restless leg syndrome. Here, take this pill. Now, what they're basically saying to you again is, look, if you're not sleeping well at night, there's something wrong with you. In fact, it's not just that you've got some stress in your life. It's not just that maybe your boyfriend and girlfriend, or your boyfriend or girlfriend is arguing with you, or your husband or wife, or your kids are driving you nuts, or you've got other challenges and stresses in your life. No, you have a more serious problem, because it's not within your control. It's a physical problem. And it might even be a cognitive problem, a mental problem. And we call it restless leg syndrome. And if you give us this amount of money, we'll solve the problem for you. Now, my point here, Michelle, is that's no different to what all these other people do. The secret was solved quite simply by saying, what is your need? We can solve your need. It's solved through law of attraction. However, the secret primarily focused on one thing. Even though it did talk about eradicating disease, it primarily focused on one thing, materialism. So it tapped into another part of the human drive, unfortunately, which is greed, instant gratification. And that's one of the negative aspects of our psyche, where we can easily give in to greed and the desire for instant gratification. So the secret talked about making money, becoming rich, having lots of stuff. The vision board was more about stuff than it was about, put up on the vision board a picture of how you're going to impact the world and how you're going to make a difference and how you're going to help people and be of service to others. No, it was about cars and houses. John Ashraf's story in The Secret was about a house. One of the teachers talked about teaching his 13-year-old kid to visualize a bicycle. Is that what a parent, a man, a father should be teaching his 13-year-old child? Instead of teaching him how to become a man and how to contribute to the world and how to weave his way through life, oh, visualize a bicycle and everything will be great. So my point is, again, to say that marketing and brainwashing is simply the identification of something in you that you feel is missing and then offering you the solution. If you happen to be in a really vulnerable state in your life because you have maybe more than one of these needs not being met and someone charismatic comes along, it's easy for you to fall into the trap. And I call it a trap because once you're in it, it's hard to get out of it. You literally feel trapped. So if you're in a position where, and let's come back to the James Ray case, because I think this is a classic example. The people, Michelle, that attended James Ray retreat were not dummies. They were not weak-minded people. They were doctors and successful business people, and one was an orthodontist. These were educated, intelligent people. One was actually a psychologist. So you have to say to yourself, well, how did they get brainwashed? Well, what did they actually do that might even be defined as being brainwashed? They entered this retreat, and in the testimony given during the trial, witnesses said that they were afraid of James Ray, that they were seeking his approval, that if they did something he didn't like, he would mock them. He set himself up as a god, and he pushed them to say, basically, ignore the physical signs of distress when you're in the sweat lodge. Ignore your body telling you that you're going to die. Now, of course, on trial, he says, no, no, I didn't say that. And his defense said, no, no, we said people could leave at any time. But the testimony was very different. And these people trusted James Ray. And here comes the next element of brainwashing. When we hand over our power to someone, we are trusting them. These people trusted their physical safety to James Ray. So brainwashing is an easy thing that can occur to all of us. We can easily get duped into buying something we don't want to buy, becoming part of a program that we don't really want to become part of a program, or even attending a seminar retreat that maybe we don't really need. The other element here is what I call the interactive dynamic between the followers and the teacher, leader, guru, or cult leader. And that means that someone sits out and says, look, I have something that you need. Now, maybe that's just knowledge. Maybe that's just some wisdom. So that person might be a teacher. Or he might say something even stronger, I have a secret. Or he might say, you have to attend these camps. You have to attend this retreat. You have to buy my product. The people now who are feeling emotionally vulnerable start to give away their power. And they say, okay, here's my money. Here's my power. I trust you. I'll listen to you. I'll be obedient. I'll do as you say. What that then does, Michelle, to the person that is receiving the power is he starts to become corrupted. In 1887, Lord Acton said, all power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So this is the same thing with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jesse James and all of these people who've been, Anthony Weiner, all these people who've been cited for betrayal and cheating and lying on their wives, on their partner, and even in some cases in situations that involve money and fraud. When a person gets into a situation of becoming powerful, they then fall into delusions of grandeur and denial. That means they start to feel invincible and entitled. Now that I'm so powerful, and this is research. Research has proved this. You can just look at all the examples around you to know that it's true. Research has shown, and even more so with men than women, that when people get into position, they start to think that the rules no longer apply to them. I can do whatever I want. I can get away with it. No one can touch me. I'm invincible, and I'm entitled. I can have whatever I want. And this is what's happened with James Ray, and it's happened with a lot of other leaders. So it's about identifying the dynamic of people giving their power to someone, then someone becomes corrupted by the power, and then engages and enacts more power over the people until they become like sheep. So they become controlled by that person. And I just want to share this with you, Michelle, that this statement by Lord Acton in 1887 was actually not about politics. We've been using this phrase for a long time when referring to politics. We use it for dictators, whether we talked about Stalin or whether we talked about Saddam Hussein or any political leaders around the world. They've often quoted, all power tends to corrupt, absolute power corrupts absolutely. But here's the interesting part. When Lord Acton wrote this, he wasn't even talking about politics. Do you know what he was talking about?
No.
Religion.
He was
actually talking about religion. He was identifying that people in positions of religious power were becoming corrupted. And we have lots of examples of that throughout many religions today. Now, the interesting thing is, you say, well, wait a minute, James Ray wasn't a religion. Mahendra Trivedi isn't a religion. And what about all these other people? They're not religions. I might argue that you're right, they're not institutionalized religion, but in many ways it's a belief in a greater power, and there's principles and there's dogma and there's followers. So it becomes very much like a religion. The New Age movement was a direct response and even a rebuttal to traditional Western religion. In the New Age movement, and even the Secret uses the same terminology, they replace the word God with universe. Ask the universe, and it should be given to you. The universe wants to help you. The universe wants to teach you. And until you get the lesson, the universe will keep sending it to you. All they did was simply replace God with the word universe. And there's many other teachings amongst them that are very, very similar. Even the basic teaching of, what goes around comes around, love thy neighbor, the golden rule, treat people the way you want to be treated, etc. So I just wanted to offer that as a background, as a foundation. Hopefully, as well, if anyone listening to this call who feels they've ever been duped or brainwashed or felt stupid or ashamed or embarrassed or humiliated by having been tricked by someone, it's okay. There's nothing wrong with you. You're just human. And it's easy to get fooled. Let me use one more example because I know you have a lot of other questions, but I really want to drive home this point, Michelle. And I'm going to use a very extreme example. Charles Manson. Now, why would I use this example? How does this fit into brainwashing? Charles Manson was more than just a cult leader. Charles Manson didn't just, like James Ray, lead people, three people to their death. He led people to kill other people. So he searched for lost souls, we'll use that phrase for the moment, and then he actually, he didn't just, you know, bring them into his family, as they called it, he then turned them into killers. So he took them to an extreme. But what's common between Charles Manson and any other cult leader? It's identifying people that are lost and then offering them meaning, purpose, love and connection, significance, security, challenge, meaning, growth, etc. Even if all of that is in a perverted or distorted way. And I just want to mention this briefly because I've done a lot of work talking about Charles Manson. And of course, Charles Manson was of a completely different league. I mean, the guy was psychopathic and sociopathic. But what's more interesting is who are the people that came to him? And in the research that was done on Charles Manson, these were all young kids. And most of them were college age and younger. And what was really interesting was a lot of them came from wealthy backgrounds. So they weren't just kids on the street who were homeless and had no meaning and no direction in life. They already came from affluent backgrounds. So how did they get sucked in? Because he tapped into what they needed. He gave them a meaning and a purpose. He gave them a significance. He gave them a connection to a different community, even though all of that was in a perverted way and in a distorted way. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. And what you've just done, Patrick, is open kind of this Pandora's box. I want to maybe hone in on something you said that really hit a button with me. You talked about the demographic of the young women who were drawn to Manson. And I'm not going to go any further than just that demographic because you and I have talked, and for anybody who doesn't know, I actually did work with the Trivedi Foundation for a short period as an independent contractor. So I was able to see some of what was happening, and it was through that experience that really has led to this overall effort to educate. But my one concern I had was this demographic, and it was young women, younger men too, and it was in the, I'm going to say, 19 to 25-year-old range that I am seeing this group of people come into the Trivedi Foundation, very innocent, vulnerable, wanting to help, and from my point of view, getting taken advantage of. So one of the things that we also, I would like to have you perhaps comment on, Patrick, is here we have this same thing happening. That was perhaps 40 years ago. It's almost a little bit of a deja vu. We have this new demographic, or just perhaps always happens over time, but we aren't always privy to it because it's not top of the media. But how does that shift happen when you start out as a teacher and then you find yourself becoming more of the guru, adored? And just to one last segue into that is an email that I just got with somebody who just participated in the June retreat. And he indicated, I can only describe a Masonic trail of thought amongst the supporters. So his observation was there was these people, hundreds of people at a retreat who were treating this person in a Masonic type of relationship. Can you expand on that for us, please?
Yes, and you raised three good points. So I will talk about that group dynamic that you're referring to in a moment. Let me come back to what you referred to as the demographics. The actual history of psychology is that psychology and philosophy were very closely interconnected in the beginning, and then eventually they branched off, and then we had people becoming philosophers, and we had people becoming psychologists. But the two are connected. And the reason I say that is that psychology tends to look more at an individual, the individual development. Philosophy talks also about sort of not just group dynamics, but the development of society, the development of people, our deeper needs. So it comes from a slightly different perspective. The reason I say that is we have to look at why is there a demographic of these young women who are the majority of people being attracted to someone like Mahendra Trivedi. why was the majority of followers of Charles Manson women? Well, and even with James Ray, without knowing all the statistics, I would easily guarantee you that the majority were women. Most of the people in personal development self-help are women. Women is the biggest audience and the biggest buying group of self-help and personal development. First, that goes back to what I said earlier when I said women are more interested in growth and personal development than men are. That's not a judgment, it's just the way it is. So that's number one. Number two, look at the difference between the feminine energy and the masculine energy. The masculine energy is very directive. The feminine energy is very receptive. So the feminine energy is about taking in, and then it's about creating. The third aspect is what's happening in society today. So in the 60s, we had a lot of these girls being attracted to Charles Manson because they came from an affluent background, but the 60s was about rebellion. It was about rebelling against the system. It was about rebelling against what's happening right now. I don't want to be controlled anymore. I want to be free. And it was literally a rebellion against the establishment. So it was easy for a charismatic man like Charles Manson to pull in these women, these young girls who came from an affluent background, but were looking for something stronger, something deeper, something more meaningful. Today, in the 21st century, we have an entirely new challenge. The challenge is we have so many broken families. We have so many children being raised by a single parent. This is not a judgment against single parents. It's simply, let's look at the great job that single parents are doing, but what is the limitation and what are the consequences? I would argue, regardless of gender or sexual orientation, that every child needs two parents, whether it's two gay parents or a heterosexual parent, a child needs two parents in the sense that it needs masculine energy and it needs feminine energy. The woman in the first few years is the one that offers the unconditional love to the child. The man, around about age 12, is saying to the kid, hey, there is conditions. This is what you have to do. So the man always tends to be the stricter one. The woman tends to be the more nurturing. She represents the feminine energy, which is nurturing, empathy, sympathy, compassion. The man represents the masculine energy. Action, direction, leadership, stamina, strength, endurance. They're two different energies. So what happens to girls when they don't have a strong father figure? When they don't have a strong male role model? Now, rather than me philosophizing, it's on my website, so I don't have the link right now, but I will send it to you. Studies that were done with 5,000 women, 5,000 girls over 10 and 15 years that identified that girls who either didn't have a father or didn't have a strong male role model or didn't have a relationship with their father were more prone to increased sexual behavior at a younger age, to unwanted pregnancy, and a host of other problems. So what they basically concluded was, oh, dad plays an important part also in the development of a girl. And the greater relationship that she has with her father, the more successful she'll become and the better and the more well-adjusted she'll become on every level. Again, this is not a judgment of mothers because I can tell you from the other perspective, the one that screws up men the most is mum, not dad. So the relationship the boys have with their mother will determine who they are more than the relation they had with their father. It's just the way it is. Not right or wrong, just the way it is. So I wanted to share that to say, if we understand that, and then we recognize that there are so many girls growing up without a father, then we understand, too, that they still need that. I've also given media interviews explaining why do girls tend to marry or date much older men. What is that phenomenon? Why is that? Now, in some cases, it's pretty obvious. You know, I used to live in Miami, South Beach, Miami, where it was common to see a beautiful, gorgeous 20-year-old girl with some 60-year-old rich man. And I just told you why. The man wanted the girl because she was young and beautiful. The girl wanted the guy because he was rich and powerful. But other than those extreme cases, when you see a girl who's dating a man who's much older than her, 10, 15, even 20 years older than her, it's usually because she's replacing the father figure. She didn't have a father figure, so she's still subconsciously looking for that father figure. Notice, too, in the Bible, how do we refer to God?
Usually as masculine.
Right. We refer to him as Father. Now, I'm not saying this is right or wrong. I don't want to get into that argument. Because the original words, from what I understand in Hebrew, given that God had no gender. But eventually, as a result of many other factors and components and elements, we gave God the gender of masculine. We talk about God the Father. Then, of course, you know, New Age came along and said, oh, no, Father, Mother, God. You know, and they changed it, or they said God has no gender. But the point is that we do place God as a father figure. And so for women, particularly these young girls, if they haven't had a strong grounding with a male figure and they seem to have a lack of direction in their life, or they have any of the needs that I identified, it's easy for them to become the primary demographic and the primary target for a James Ray, a Charles Manson, a Mahendra Tavidi, and all the others that we haven't even talked about today. Now, I think your final question was about two questions. You wanted to know, how does a teacher morph into a guru or a cult leader? And you talked also about, and please repose the question regarding the reference to people becoming almost Masonic.
Yes.
Could you ask that question again so I can answer it properly?
Yeah. I'm just going to read it to you as it came to us, because I thought it was really just perfect for this. This gentleman was at a retreat, and he says, I can only describe it was a Masonic trail of thought amongst the supporters, and he was wondering what my opinion was, because he knew that I had also been there just for a short time too. So I had not responded, and I would love to know your opinion, because I think even, and maybe you've answered it just as you've been talking about how perhaps in some way Trivedi came as that father figure or as that expert in his area, and for whatever reason people were following him. But I'm real curious about how does it then become the Masonic image that people start literally worshiping him, which appears to be happening at some of these retreats.
Oh, I see what you mean. I thought you meant Masonic as in the Masons. You mean almost like Trivedi is becoming a messiah to these people.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm glad that you cleared that up for me, because I wasn't sure. Okay, so the first thing is, from a psychological perspective, in group dynamics, the group becomes the total result of the mindset of the majority of people that came to the group. So if the majority of the people came to the group with a mindset that we're lost, we're helpless, we're powerless, we need something, we're looking for something, then that person in a position of power responds to that. So this is the same way that riots begin. That, for example, a large group of people merge onto an area and their mindset is already anger, revenge, hatred, bitterness, vindictiveness. They're bringing that mindset, so it's easy. Once one person in that group does something, throws that first punch, throws that first bottle, smashes that window, people will follow, because you already have the fuel, which is the mindset. So if these people are coming here to Mahendra Tavidi and they're lost, they're looking for something, they're looking for a leader, it's very easy for them to look up to this person because they already want someone to fill that role for them. Having said that, generally in society, people need someone to follow. They look for a leader. And if they don't have a leader in their life, for example, I can assure you that if we were to get a detailed analysis of all of the people that are in part of this retreat where Trivedi was, I can assure you the majority of them would not be strong in any other religion.
So because they had perhaps no other standard is not the right word, but I'll use it, perhaps already defined religions such as Christianity or Judaism or Islam, they might be more susceptible because they don't have that community that's already established that they would relate to.
That's one of the aspects. It's many others. It's again coming back to significance, you're right, connection to a wider community, growth, meaning and purpose, challenge, security, etc. Now, I'm not saying the religion is good or bad. I'm simply saying if these people are already in a religious group, then they already have a leader, whether that leader is Jesus, Allah, Buddha, or a range of gods. They already have a leader, someone that they put up on a pedestal, someone else that they worship. If you have a person that's looking for a leader and looking for meaning and purpose and looking for connection to a wider community and wants to belong to something and feels helpless and lost and powerless, then it's easy for them to fall into a thing such as a cult or a group or a following of someone like Dravidi, who, incidentally, and this must be stated very clearly because it's another point I want to touch on, has promoted himself through his marketing. So his marketing team has promoted him. You use the next coming or the second coming of Christ. The original marketing was referring to him as Albert Einstein and Jesus. Now, let me just find it because I want to read that specifically for what was the exact wording. Mr. Dravidi's mission, and I'm quoting here from the 2010 internal marketing plan about Dravidi. Mr. Dravidi's mission on this planet is unique. Never before has a person been born with Mr. Dravidi's qualities and gifts. Many compare him to Jesus Christ or Einstein. Others may rise up in offense, declaring outrage against Mr. Dravidi's gifts. The brand should be prepared to weather extreme reactions. Now, what they're saying right there is, this man is Jesus Christ and he's Albert Einstein. Don't tell me who we're saying he's being compared to. Why would you be acknowledging and validating other people's comparisons? Who are these other people? That's just marketing terminology or garb, I mean garbage, to say that we are telling you in a subliminal way, not a subliminal way, but I'm trying to find the right terminology, but we are actually suggesting to you that he is Jesus and he's Albert Einstein, but we're not telling it to you directly because we're attributing it to another group of people. We're saying some people have compared him. Who are these some people? So it would be like me saying, some people say Michelle is the hottest, sexiest, most intelligent woman on the planet.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. What I've just said is, I've given you those qualities by saying someone else has said it about you. So in the marketing, they're trying to subconsciously convince people that this man, Dravidi, is Jesus Christ and Albert Einstein. So let's look at that for a moment. I'll start with Albert Einstein first. Albert Einstein was a scientist and a physicist. Dravidi's not a scientist and he's not a physicist. Albert Einstein wrote 300 scientific papers. I don't think Mr. Dravidi's done that. Albert Einstein was recognized as a genius. We can't make any conclusions about Mr. Dravidi because we haven't seen conclusive scientific evidence. I'll come back to that because I know any of Dravidi's followers will be quite annoyed by that statement. Albert Einstein was partly responsible for the theory of quantum physics. Albert Einstein came up with a whole new perspective on the theory of relativity. He changed science. Albert Einstein won the Nobel Peace Prize. Albert Einstein was directly responsible for the creation of the atomic bomb, even though he actually was against it and spoke very strongly against the use of atomic power as a weapon. But he's the one that came up with it. Albert Einstein, in 1999, was named as Time Magazine's Man of the Year. So when you come out and say, Mahendra Dravidi is like Albert Einstein, what about him are you saying? Are you saying that Dravidi is a scientist, a physicist? Has he wrote 300 scientific papers? Has he won the Nobel Peace Prize? What has he done that has impacted humanity on a global level? Because that's what Albert Einstein has done, number one. So I don't see any comparisons to Albert Einstein unless Mr. Dravidi happened to be born in the German Empire and was Jewish. But I don't think he was. All right. Now we say some people have compared him to Jesus. What do you mean by that? Are you saying that Dravidi is the Son of God? Are you saying that Dravidi is perfect the way that Jesus was? Are you saying that Dravidi has been compared to Jesus because Dravidi is conducting miracles and healing people spontaneously? If you're saying that, you need to have clear documentation and proof of that. Here's why. So far, the scientific evidence that's been presented has all come from India. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you look very carefully at it, there is nothing clear that says Michelle XYZ came along, we did a test, and then Michelle XYZ, 5 minutes later, we tested her, and her whole blood had changed, and her whole hormonal group had changed. That is not in the scientific evidence. Then we have Penn State University, the only U.S. institution to test Mr. Trivedi, saying, we were eager to find something great in this, and there was nothing here, nothing. Then Penn State University, remember this is an academic institution that is looking at it scientifically, because if you are going to present me scientific evidence, then I should be able to look at it scientifically and question it. And Penn State says, well, we also looked at the fields that he says he blessed, the crops. Mr. Trivedi took a field that was not sprayed by any chemicals, and he blessed it. Then he compared it to another field that he hadn't blessed, but which incidentally had been sprayed by chemicals. Were those fields next to each other? So there's a lot of points here, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here. So you've got to look at the documentation and the evidence. Now the next thing is, there are people who are going to say, well, wait a minute, Patrick. I went, or I attended Mr. Trivedi's seminar, or I was on his phone call, or he blessed me, and I was healed. Or my father was healed, or my mother was healed, or my brother was healed. So then let's look at the claim that Mr. Trivedi is a healer. Can anyone really heal you? Well, let's go back to the person that's being recognized as the greatest healer of all time, and that would be Jesus Christ. If you carefully look at all the scriptures in the Gospels of Jesus, and incidentally, I've studied comparative religion. I wrote a small book called Finding God, Spiritual Strategies to Help You Find Happiness, Fulfillment, and Inner Peace. So I have delved into this area. So I'm looking at it now from a different perspective too, the behavioral perspective, the psychological perspective, and even the spiritual perspective. But looking at it from almost from a scientific perspective, you look at the scriptures, and the scriptures say, Jesus could do no great works in his own hometown. And it says, he could do no great works there. So Jesus in his own hometown couldn't do any healing and couldn't do any miracles. Why? Why would that be? And then you go a little bit deeper in the scriptures, because the people in his own hometown saw him as a carpenter. They didn't see him as the Son of God. They didn't see him as a miracle worker. They didn't see him as someone who has supernatural powers from God. So he could do no healing. Now, please stay with me here, because the point will be made very quickly. Then you look at the other scriptures, and in almost every case where Jesus performs a miracle and does a healing, he often asks, I use the word in almost every case, he would ask the question before he would do the healing, do you believe I can do this? Why would Jesus ask that question? Why did he ask people, do you believe I can do this? And then they said yes, and then he would heal them. Does that mean he wouldn't have healed them if they said he couldn't? And yet he couldn't heal the people in his own hometown who didn't believe in him. What that's saying is that the people's belief played a big part in their healing. And at the end of the healing, Jesus would say something like, and now your sins are forgiven. Why did he say that? Why did he say at the end of the healing, or as part of the healing, the closing words, now your sins are forgiven? Was Jesus saying that part of their physical illness was a result of their own mental, emotional state, their own state of consciousness? It's something to consider. Finally, there's another scripture where Jesus is about to heal, I think, some blind people, or he's about to heal one or two people. And he says, but don't tell anyone that I've done this. And the reason he says that is because he wants to get away, literally to escape, because the rest of the scripture talks about him escaping through the crowd. He wants to get away and escape so he can pray and meditate, so he can regroup and re-energize. And I often use that scripture with my clients who are of a religious background to say, notice here that Jesus took time out for himself. Notice that Jesus said, you know what? I need to take care of myself. I need to say no occasionally. But the greater implication in the scripture, the greater significance is, as Jesus is moving through the crowd and he's running through the crowd, he's trying to get away, he feels some energy being drawn out of his body. He turns around and he notices that a woman was grabbing at his robe because she wanted to be healed, and the scripture goes on to say that she was healed. How was she healed? All she did was touch his robe. Jesus didn't do a prayer. He didn't do a meditation. He didn't use the words, "Now I heal you." He didn't say, "Now your sins are forgiven." All it took was for her to touch him. But what is the significance of the touch? It's that she believed he could heal her. So she was saying to herself, "If I can just touch him, I'll be healed." So who was really healing her? Was it her own belief? So I'm saying to you and to people listening now, for the people that have been healed as a result of the claimed blessings of Mr. Trevitti, is he really doing the healing, or are people healing themselves as a result of their own faith and their own belief in the ability and power of Mr. Trevitti? And I'll answer that question, or I'll reinforce that point by using another example, what we call the placebo effect. And I think everyone listening to this call has heard the term placebo effect. But let me explain it in a very simple way. When science, or even a drug company, is testing a new pill, a new medication, a new drug, they'll get a group of people, a group of volunteers, and they'll say, "Okay, we need a group of volunteers who all have pains in their stomach and have had them for more than 3 years. Along come all the volunteers. And they say, "Well, in our hands now, we have this new medication that we believe, or we found, will heal people of stomach ailments. So we'd like you to take it for 7 days and then tell us, you know, what are the results?" The results come back, and what they find is that almost an equal amount of people were healed by taking a fake pill, or a large percentage. So maybe the pill worked, say, at 95%. Let's take the group of 100%. They found that 20% of people were healed of their stomach ailment, but they never took the real pill. And the doctor comes along and says, "Well, Michelle, I need to tell you that the pill we just gave you was actually a fake pill." "What? What do you mean it was a fake pill?" "Well, it wasn't the drug. We just gave you a pill that was nothing but sugar." "But that's not possible, Mr. Doctor, because my stomach ailment's gone." "Well, I'm sorry, we don't know how that happened, but we call that the placebo effect, which is simply another way of saying you believed it, you expected it, you anticipated it, and therefore it happened. And it became real." Now, I would like to use one more example which has nothing to do with healing, but which will blow your mind. And I've got this example on my website, and again, it's another link I'll send you because I think it's really valid, to talk about the power of belief and the power of visualization. And I don't know whether it was UCLA, but I believe it was I'd have to check the details on my site, but it was a college in California, I think it was in the 70s, did a test, and it took a bunch of people, and it wanted to test their basketball abilities. So what it did was it said, "We're going to have three groups of people. Group number one, we're going to test all of you, how can you shoot a hoop? Okay, let's write down the results. Now, group number one, we want you to practice 1 hour every day for the next 7 days. Group number two, we want you to visualize shooting the hoop successfully every day for an hour for the next 7 days. And group number three, we want you to do nothing at all. And we'll see you in 7 days. I think the study might have been 30 days. But nonetheless, at the end of that period, group number three, who did nothing and didn't practice, didn't rehearse, had no improvement in their results. Group number one, which practiced shooting the hoops every day for an hour, improved by about 23%. Group number two, who did no exercise, they didn't get on the basketball court and practice shooting hoops. All they did was picture it in their mind, physically improved their ability to shoot a hoop by 22%. So that means there was a physical shift in their ability to shoot a basketball hoop purely by visualizing it and feeling it, believing it to be real. There was no James Ray. There was no Mahendra Trivedi, who did a blessing on them and said, "When I bless you, you'll shoot better hoops by 22%. These people did it themselves. My point is that we do have the ability to heal ourselves of many ailments. We do have the ability to improve our physical capacity. We do have the ability to even improve our skills purely by our belief. And the reason I used the example of visualization was because when these people were visualizing it, they were feeling it to be real. And I did this test on a cruise ship with kids when we were playing, what's that golf where you just use a little mini golf? Mini golf? It's mini golf.
I could have told you before you asked me.
All right, sorry.
Putt-putt golf is what it's referred to.
Yeah, it's like putt-putt golf. So I just thought, this was a long, long time ago, when I just started studying hypnosis and hypnotherapy, and I thought, let me test this. Why not? So I watched these kids, and I said, okay, before you do this, while you're holding this golf stick in your hand, I want you just to close your eyes and really imagine and feel that ball going in to the hole. And after you felt it and you believed it, you saw it, go ahead and finish the stroke. Every kid that did it got it in, every time.
Wow.
Because they visualized it, they felt it, they believed it. Another quick example, many, many years ago, I was teaching at Unity Church of Christianity in Houston, Texas. And I was a Sunday school teacher. And so I would love to do experiments with kids to prove to them about the power of their own thoughts. And I would say to them, how many of you have ever, girls or boys, seen a girl or a boy and went, oh, wow, and you got butterflies in your stomach? And I said, but that boy or girl didn't touch you, did they? You were just looking at them. What happened? And they're now thinking, yeah, that is weird. It was a thought that gave me butterflies in my stomach. I said, how many of you have looked at something and felt like throwing up? Everyone has. Not just kids, obviously, adults. And it's just a thought, a picture, that creates a physical reaction in your body. The next thing I did with these kids, because I still love to experiment, and this was a long time ago again, when I just started studying hypnosis and hypnotherapy, I took the kids and I said, okay, I want you to do something really simple. Put your arm out, level with your shoulder. Okay, watch how I push down on it. See how strong it is? Yeah. Now, keep your body strong and push down on it, right? Good. See how strong you are? Good. Now, relax your arm. Now, I want you to repeat to yourself, I'm weak, I'm weak, I'm weak. Just 10 times, but really feel it. Now, put your arm out again straight and watch me push down. And you know that immediately as I push down, their arm is weak. Why? Because they just kept telling themselves they're weak until they felt it, until it became a reality in their body. I know these are really simple, maybe overly simplified. They're not scientific studies, but it's a way of simply illustrating a point that we have the ability via our thoughts and our belief to change certain aspects of ourselves.
Can I ask a question, Patrick, because what you've prompted is this whole question of if we do all have that ability, and even going back to James Ray and some of the other self-help people and the affiliates and who got into this for making money, at what point do you shift from being a self-help instructor, kind of along this Trivedi theory, but you go to the consumption, and it's really the concept of ego that I want to get to. It's really interesting having you tell me about the studies. And what is it within ourselves that limits us from being able to, whatever you want to call it, self-actualize or heal ourselves? Is it that concept of ego, or how does that play into it, please?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because we're talking about two things. We're talking about, can I heal myself? Yes, we can. To what extent? I don't know. I don't have the answer. I'm not pretending I have the answer to that. Obviously, there are some limitations. One might argue, well, it's only based on our own, the limitations of our mind. Okay, but that's a philosophy. That's a philosophical perspective. But in terms of ego and how we transform and become corrupted, we all have the capacity to become corrupted. My friend and colleague, Professor Philip Zimbardo, Professor Emeritus of Stanford, is a guy who's the world's, probably the world, he's definitely America's best-known psychologist and maybe the world's most renowned psychologist. He is a guy that's been studying human behavior for 40 or 50 years. He did an experiment, and this will answer your question, so the reason I'm mentioning this. He did an experiment back in, I think the year was like 1970, and it's recognized now as the Stanford Prison Experiment. It changed the entire teaching around psychology. He did a basic experiment where he took, and I won't go into the details of the experiment, but basically he took a group of volunteers. Some became acted as prisoners, some acted as wardens, and it was going to be a two-week experiment where they had to pretend and live out the role of being a prisoner and a warden. Some of them, the kids thought that they were actually being taken prisoner. And the other people, the wardens, had to pretend they were wardens. The experiment was meant to go on for 2 weeks. After a week, they had to cancel it. Philip Zimbardo had to stop the experiment because the wardens were becoming really evil. They were torturing these prisoners who were just, you know, kids. They hadn't even committed real crime. They had just agreed to be part of an experiment, and then they suddenly were kidnapped and taken to this makeshift prison. They didn't realize what they were in for. The conclusion, and this will answer your question, the conclusion that came from this study is something that's been around forever, but it was now verified by science. We all have the capacity to commit good and evil. There's good and evil in all of us. Now that goes back to Star Wars. How there's the good and the bad in all of us. But that's not a new principle. It's in the Bible. Jesus in the Last Supper talks about how one of the people who's his follower, his disciple, is going to betray him. Now we go, oh, that would never be me. That would never be me. Really? Even the people who were his disciples that spent time with him still did wrong things. Look at Peter. My point is that we all have the capacity to commit good and evil. And Professor Philip Zimbardo has duplicated that result numerous times with numerous experiments, that we all have the capacity to commit good and evil. There's another one, if you want to research it, if you ask it to, I'll send you the link on my blog, what was known as the Stanley Milligram experiment, where these people, in an experiment, would actually deliberately inflict pain on someone else. And you go, oh, I would never do that. Yes, you would, because you're like everyone else. You have the capacity to commit good and evil. My point being, whether we want to call that ego, whatever spiritual term you want to give it, I'm simply saying we have the capacity, and therefore in every moment we have the choice to commit good or evil. Also, if you believe that Mahendra Trivedi can do a blessing on you, which means put something positive on you, then you also have to believe in the existence of something evil. But if there's a blessing, there must be a curse, because you can't have one without the other. Having said that, I'll answer your question about ego and how power corrupts and how we transform. The very first thing is you have to start out with the right intention. Is my intention to heal people, or is my intention to become really rich, really powerful, and really famous? Because Jesus didn't charge people for healing. Now, I know Jesus was in a different society, and that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be well rewarded and well compensated for our gifts, our talents, and our abilities. Of course we should. They've been given to us. We should use them to help other people, and we should be well paid for them. But if you're now going to start charging people extraordinary amounts of money and thousands of dollars to do this work, is the work about your gift and about your ability to heal and make a difference? Or is it about money, power, ego, greed, and instant gratification? If Mahendra Trivedi has this gift, why is he only sharing it with people who can afford it? Why doesn't he walk down Venice Beach to all the homeless people? Why doesn't he go around the country and heal homeless people? What a great example of saying some people have compared him to Jesus. If you're going to compare him to Jesus, then let him be humble like Jesus and go and heal the prostitutes, the homeless people, the sick people, everyone, not just the people who have saved up their money or run a credit card. That's a key point. So you have to look at it and say, why does it have to be charged so much? Here's another thing I'll share. Not many people might know about this. One of the original live teleseminar phone calls that Mr. Trivedi did, talking about selling his blessings and talking about his work, a caller said to him, well, what about the Gulf spill? This was around the time of the Gulf spill, so it was in 2010. Could you, since you have the power to heal and transform matter and do physical transformations. Can't you reverse the Gulf spill? Can't you clear out all the oil? The science can't do it right now. He says, yes, of course I can. But they're not paying me enough. They're not offering me enough money. They'll have to offer me a lot of money to do that. Really? So you care so much about humanity, about people, about helping, about healing, that you're saying, you know what, I see tens of thousands of birds dying. I see the shrimp industry destroyed. I see people's lives impacted. I see nature and all the plant life in the ocean being killed by this oil. But, and I could actually change it, but I won't unless you give me money. Why? Because I need the money. Because I need to buy a bigger house and have more cars and more possessions. And I want to be like James Ray. I want to live in Beverly Hills. I want to walk with all the celebrities. So what I'm saying is look at people's intentions and motivations. James Ray may have set out to be a great teacher, and I think he was a great teacher. I think he definitely had a message. But then what happened to him? He decided he wanted to live in Beverly Hills. Now, most of the self-help gurus and all the people from The Secret tend to live in San Diego, Encinitas, La Jolla. That's the spiritual enclave. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying that's what it happens to be for people that are listening that are curious, where do these people live? Anthony Robbins lives in La Jolla. Most of these people tend to live in Encinitas, La Jolla, San Diego. You might say, well, that's because it's a beautiful place. Yeah, it is. It really is. James Ray decided he wanted to buy a multi-million-dollar home in Beverly Hills. Is there anything wrong with that? No, there's not. But why did you choose Beverly Hills, James? Because you're a teacher of The Secret. You could live anywhere. Do you not want to live on the mountains or the ocean? You want to live in Beverly Hills. Why is that? And why did you choose to go to an anti-aging doctor to look really young and to take hormones, growth hormones, so you can stay young? Is that about your message? Do you believe that if you don't look young, people won't listen to you? Do you believe that people only believe in The Secret if they actually see you as being young? And if The Secret and the law of attraction is so powerful and it can transform our bodies, because the book, the movie, and the book The Secret says if you're fat, it's because you have fat thoughts. So why did James Ray need to turn to growth hormones? Why didn't he just have young thoughts? And Mr. Dravidi, hasn't it been claimed by some people that Mr. Dravidi has had 2 facelifts, that he's had plastic surgery? Why isn't he just blessing himself? Why doesn't he look in the mirror and bless himself and say, I'm younger now? And why is it important to be young? Are we talking about what matters as being something inside of us or something outside of us? Because if you're now talking about materialism and vanity and greed and lust and ego, then you're no different to anyone else. And incidentally, I'll share this with you. I'm sure you want to get me off the phone by now.
No, this is fascinating, and we appreciate every minute that you're spending with us. So please.
Thank you. And as you can tell, this is one of my passions. And incidentally, I'm not getting paid for this. And please don't compare me to Jesus, Albert Einstein, or anyone else.
Okay.
Marketing, a long time ago, somebody in marketing said this to me. He said, here is the secret to marketing. You appeal to only 3 things. Lust, vanity, and greed. Lust, sexy. You know, you can get more sex, get more girls. Vanity, ooh, you can look younger, be slimmer, be skinnier. And greed, money, material possessions. So look at all the marketing, all these people. Are they marketing to making a real difference, or are they marketing to lust, vanity, and greed? What are they really marketing to, and what is their intention behind? Is it to satisfy their own needs of lust, vanity, and greed? The same applies to a lot of these other spiritual healers. For a long time, Deepak was dyeing his hair gray. He was dyeing his hair that was gray. Why? Why not just accept where you are? Isn't that about the 7 spiritual laws of success? Isn't that about spirituality? Isn't that one of the key principles of spirituality? Self-acceptance? Accepting yourself as you are? Or are we trying to create an image so that people will like us? Now, there's nothing wrong with dyeing your hair. There's nothing wrong with having a facelift. There's nothing wrong with taking growth hormones to stay young, unless you teach that those things aren't important and you teach that you can create those things with your own power. Then it's a problem. But I think to properly answer your question, how did these people become corrupted? It's ego, vanity, greed, lust for power. That's what happened to James Ray. That's what's happened to a lot of people. Where now, they're more interested in hanging out with the celebrities than they are hanging out with the average person. Deepak was always hanging out with, Demi Moore and Madonna and all these people. Well, why are they so important? Unless you truly believe that they're going to spread your message. And not necessarily. Why are you hanging out with all the celebs? As you know, I have high-profile clients, and yes, some of them are celebrities. You don't see me walking around with them and being really cool and hip. Unless I feel, and I said to them, look, you have a platform. You, Demi Moore, could convince the world to stop being vain or to pray more or to help more. And guess what? She and her husband, Ashton Kutcher, are doing something that has nothing to do with any of the Deepak Chopra teachers. They're trying to stop sex trafficking around the world, human trafficking. It had nothing to do with Deepak or the Kabbalah or anything else. It was their own mission, their own purpose that they found on their own. So, I'm not. What I commend you for is that you've become a skeptic, but there are only two kinds of skeptics. There's the skeptic that believes that everything is BS and there's no truth anywhere. Then there's the skeptic that is the seeker of truth. The seeker of truth keeps an open mind and says, I'm willing to look at all the evidence for and against, because you can challenge my beliefs and it doesn't matter. So, and I was going to lead to one final point. It's important that we keep our mind open as a seeker of truth, because if something is true, it doesn't matter what angle you come at it from, it will always be the same. If you take truth, you can look at it from a 360-degree angle and it does not change. But people who in their heart have a fear that what they believe, what they think is truth is not truth, are afraid to look at that truth in case they realize this is not truth. So I would say to all the people who promote Tridi, look at it, look at the real documentation. If you are sending out blasts of emails, all the thousands of people that are being healed, send me those names, send me the real healing, and show me the documentation. Anyone can say that thousands of people have been healed. How many thousands? 1,000, 2,000, 10,000, 100,000? How many thousands? Have they been documented, or are you just doing what most people do in marketing, which is basically BS? Are there really thousands of documented cases? And if there are, why is there not one documented case from any institution in the U.S.? Why has Mr. Dravidi not gotten on any TV show and performed a miracle live on television? Why? Because he doesn't want to be tested, but he's being tested at his retreats, and he's charging for it. The same applies to everyone. If I say that I have a truth, that truth must be able to be tested. It's got to be tested, otherwise it's not truth. So and the same thing applies to some of these other teachers of the secret, the secret in the law of attraction, who've twisted it. One person comes out and says, when being asked what is the law of attraction, says, what you give out, what you send out comes back to you. That's not the law of attraction, that's the teaching of karma. That has nothing to do with the law of attraction. Because law of attraction is about putting pictures up on the wall and manifesting something. It's not about giving out good energy and getting back good energy. It's much more than that. Then you have the people who say, well, James Ray created his reality using the law of attraction. Really? Did he have pictures of himself in a prison uniform or in a court of law? And then some of his supporters come out and say, well, yes, it's because, as Abraham Hicks teaches, it happened at a soul level. His soul created this. So we're now saying the first hypothesis of law of attraction can be explained by the second hypothesis, which is at a soul level. So what you're saying now is James Ray killed three people because it was something that he did at his own soul level for his own growth, and these three people that died did it at their soul level. Well, if we're being controlled at a soul level, why do we even believe in the law of attraction? Because obviously the soul level overrides the law of attraction. I'm going off at a tangent, but here's my final point, that there are other teachers who have huge followers and will literally say and use the words, you can change everything and anything in an instant by your thought. And that very person who's saying that to you is 30, 40, 50 pounds overweight and has been for years and years. So I would look that person in the eye and say, if you really believe that all change happens in an instant, why don't you instantly change, not for the sake of vanity to lose 30 or 40 pounds, but because you recognize that being overweight by 30 or 40 pounds puts pressure on your heart, can lead to diabetes, and is seriously dangerous for you. Why not? Because it's easy, Michelle, to say things that bring in money when people don't question us and don't expect validation and evidence. And it's the same criticism that people have of extreme religious people. Fanaticism. And we have to be aware of it. So here's my final point. And this is a question that's being posed to me by an investigative journalist regarding this whole situation with Hanu Trivedi. Why do some of his followers refuse to accept the possibility that maybe it's not real? And it's the same. It's the same thing that happened to James Ray's followers in the beginning. And I'll explain what I mean by that. It's called cognitive dissonance, whereby we suddenly have evidence put in front of us, and we go, "This can't be true. I've always believed Mr. Ray to be great. I put all my faith in him. I put my trust in him. I believed in him. I gave him my money. I gave him my energy. I gave him my time. I can't believe that this is true. So what do? I deny it." Guess who else does that? Women that find out their husband has cheated. Often, they'll deny it at first. They'll go straight into denial. It can't be true because I always believed in my husband. I trusted him. I had faith in him. So the only way I can balance these two conflicting ideas is that I'll deny one, until the evidence is presented again and again, and then that woman realizes it's true, he did cheat on me, that belief takes over, and then she throws him out of the house or divorces him or does something else. And that's what happened to the James Ray's people. Right after the sweat lodge, when the emergency services were called, and emergency services showed up and police showed up, the majority of James Ray's people who came right out of that sweat lodge said, "There's nothing wrong. Nothing happened. Everything was fine. There was no trauma. Everyone was fine." That's cognitive dissonance. They were in complete denial. So some people on trial, as a witness, during the James Ray trial said, "Yeah, I said that. I don't know why I said that. But it's not the truth." Eventually what happens is it sinks in and their mind accepts the new reality, which was hard to swallow at first, to accept I was duped or I was wrong. Simply, I was wrong. I believed James Ray to be this great person. I trusted him. I believed in him. And he did something really wrong. And now I have to create a new image of him and a new image of myself because I put my faith and my belief in him. And if I accept that I was wrong about him, what does that mean for me? What does that mean for my future life? Can I still live with myself? Can I still continue? I'm lost now. He was my purpose. He was my direction. I trusted in him. So it's very hard for people to accept that. And I don't know from your experiences, I'm sure that you can share that, to say, you know, what you experienced working with him and then choosing to go a different path. So I don't know if that answers all your questions, Michelle, but I've talked for a long time.
No, that was brilliant. And I was just taking so much of your time. I don't want to go any further because I know you have other commitments, but I just want to tell you one, Patrick, it has been a pleasure, and what my biggest hope was, I had a hope going into this interview with you, was that anybody who may have questioned, just as you summed up, why did I do this, geez, I got duped, and I feel kind of guilty or embarrassed about this, you have just helped explain so many things in such a beautiful way for a lot of people listening. We've learned a lesson, and all we can do is go forward and charge on and carry on and try to do the right thing as we know it. And so thank you for spending the time. And to anybody listening, just know that it's okay. There are a lot of people who may have come in for good intentions. In my personal perspective, the most important thing is, what do you do once you have the knowledge? Do you then make that quietly, I can't do anything, or do you decide I'm going to make a good decision and move on? So for anybody who would like to learn more about Patrick and everything that he has said, it's just blown me away, and I really highly recommend anybody who would like to learn more about it, go to his website. It's www.patrickwanis.com. And take a look. He's just a phenomenal individual. He's given us some real tools and some real concepts about why some of these things might have been happening. And again, just thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Patrick, thank you for doing this. You had nothing to gain by it, but you chose to do it. And so perhaps you've done what Trivedi hasn't. You've chosen to walk Venice Beach with the average person and share your expertise to help make a difference. And for that, may you have a fantastic day, and thank you for sharing your time with us.
It's my pleasure, Michelle. I just want to say thank you for thanking me. It's okay for us to be selfish and to say, I'm going to help you because I'm going to feel better for helping you. Do you understand what I mean by that?
Yes, I do.
So in my helping you, I feel good when I help you. And I think that that's the point that for all of us is look back at your intention and say, okay, maybe I was part of this group. Now I learned something. How can I help other people? How can I use my knowledge and wisdom to help other people to make a positive difference? I haven't, and this is the last thing I want to say, this is really important. Please don't put me on a pedestal. Please feel free to embrace the message that I've shared with you and to say, that's a really good message, and I learned a lot from it. But what I'm saying about me is what I want to say about you. We're all humans. We all make mistakes. We're all imperfect. It's okay that you made a mistake. If you whoever you is, got duped or got brainwashed or felt that you were made fool of or you felt embarrassed or stupid from your actions or behavior, we all make mistakes. And we have to learn from those mistakes. Because if you can't forgive yourself for the mistake you made, you won't be able to forgive the people in your life, your husband, your wife, or your children or your friends. Forgiveness starts with you. Forgive yourself for making a mistake. It's okay. You made a mistake. That's why you're human. Then you move forward. And that's the primary part of the message, and that's the key point. Separate the message from the messenger. Don't fall in love with the messenger. Embrace the message if the message is good.
Perfectly put. I think that's a perfect way to end it.
All right, Michelle. Well, I thank you, and I honor and respect the work you've done and are doing.
Thank you. Best wishes to you, and I hope to meet you again.
All right, Michelle. Thank you.
Take care, Patrick. Bye.
Bye.